This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When your mother said, listen to your mother, she was probably saying something you didn't want to hear. But this year, women around the triangle are putting a new spin on that dreaded phrase. Listen to Your Mother is a theatrical performance that celebrates the diverse experiences of motherhood. The show is on stage at Keenan Auditorium in Raleigh tonight and Thursday, May 8th. And we're going to get a preview right now, and we will begin with Kian Hogue. Kian is the manager of market research at NC State and also the show's co-producer. Kian, welcome.
Good to have you.
Thank you. Tell us about this project itself. How did it get started?
Well, it started in 2010 in Madison, Wisconsin, and it's started by Ann Emick, and it took off from there. And her goal was to try to give a voice to motherhood and a microphone to Mother's Day, and to celebrate what at that point was the burgeoning blogging community, and to try to give them an opportunity to share their stories more widely. And so each year since 2010, it spread to other cities, and it's always local readers, local writers. And now this is our second year in Raleigh-Durham, and we're thrilled.
And as you said, this conversation had gotten started. I think it was one of the battlefields in the Mommy Wars where the question of motherhood was being explored, at least on the Internet.
Correct.
And so this is a chance to sort of do this in a more deliberate and articulate way, and also bring audiences in, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
How does that affect how is that different? Because, you know, those blog sites were definitely generating a conversation, but it was all a kind of virtual conversation. What's the difference, do you think? And what's the effect of actually bringing an audience into the room and making eye contact with the experience?
Well, I think that reading a story is one experience, and there's certainly a community around that makes that a viable and legitimate option for getting your story out. But there is something about giving voice to those words and that intimacy of having the people in the audience go, me too. I never knew anyone actually felt that way. And people who might never read a blog, but who would still recognize these stories.
And let's go back to that writing experience. I mean, the bloggers were obviously self-selected. These were people who wanted to get the word out for whatever reason. But now you're encouraging mothers to write. And I would think that in many ways is a different experience for women who didn't think that they wanted to tell their story or that they were ready to tell their stories. Tell us about that and the effect
that's,
of that.
That's very true, because the majority of the women in both of the casts each year were not bloggers. A few of them had blogs, but most of them were women who wanted to write, who wanted to tell their story, who had something to say, and they wanted to get it out there.
Well, I know that you have prepared something, right?
Yes.
For the performance. Can you give us a sample?
Yes.
Do we need to know anything before we hear what you're about to read?
It is about my son's birth experience. The bones of my birth story and becoming a mother are like everyone else's. A woman in labor in the hospital, the hum of the equipment monitoring the woman and the baby, the nurses moving in and out, moans and contractions intensified, and soothing words. But the details are different. I was not the woman in labor, although the baby being born was my biological child. The woman in labor was our gestational carrier. Not many mothers have the opportunity to watch their child being born. It was amazing and beautiful and bloody and gruesome, and the moment is burned in my memory forever. After 4 years of infertility with nothing to show but failure and despair, I finally held my baby in my arms. I looked over at our surrogate Felicia, and she was looking at us and smiling. And I smiled back, hoping my smile said what I was feeling and how thankful for her I was. They say it takes a village to raise a child, and sometimes it takes a village to have one, and it took a village to make me a mother.
Kian Hogue, one of the co-producers of Listen to Your Mother, on stage now and Thursday in Raleigh. How long had you been thinking about, or had you been thinking about writing about this surrogacy, the fact that there was a surrogate mother for you?
Well, I've written off and on since my son was born. He'll be 5 in June, and so it's never been a secret. But when I had an opportunity to sit down and try to really put more succinctly words of our experience together, it was a great opportunity to be able to do that.
You are on the verge of emotion right now, and and this is a piece that you've, as you said, you've been writing a blog, you've been writing about this and talking about it. How does it change things for you to say it out loud and to say it to people in this room who are generally sympathetic and pulling for you?
Well, a lot of emphasis is placed on the physical aspects of motherhood and the pregnancy and giving birth. And a lot of times that's the words that are shared. You know, oh, well, how is nursing going, or how have you lost the weight, or how much did you tear, or anything like that. And so I don't have that experience, but I wanted to be able to say that, you know, there are many different paths to motherhood, and my birth experience may not be the same as others' experiences, but it's just as important, it's just as meaningful to us as any other birth experience.
Well, Listen to Your Mother is a stage production that brings many, many, many experiences of motherhood to the stage. Another cast member is with us now. Mandy Hitchcock is a UNC law professor and a frequent blogger. Welcome, Mandy. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
When did you start writing regularly about motherhood?
I blogged a little bit after my first daughter was born. But then I didn't really start writing regularly until about a month after she died.
Tell us about that experience.
She was about 17 months old, and it was actually Mother's Day weekend. So we're coming up on anniversary this next week. And she had a fever, which was very common for toddlers her age. She was in daycare. And it progressed to the point that we got concerned enough to take her to the doctor, and eventually she was diagnosed with bacterial meningitis.
And that works very quickly.
It does. Even in her case, it was surprising to everyone, even the doctors. The kind that she had is the most typically fatal. But even in most cases, babies, even kids her age especially, would survive. But for some reason, it was just an incredibly aggressive infection.
And Hudson was your first child.
She was.
When did you think to start writing about this?
So even during the process of the time that we were at the hospital, my husband and I both were engaging with our friends near and far over Facebook, and it wasn't something that I ever imagined would be such an incredible source of support for us. But we were figuratively being held aloft by our friends and family all over the country and eventually all over the world. And so after she died, I was posting fairly regularly on Facebook, and eventually I got to the point where I thought, there's just more of this that I need to process than I can do on Facebook, and that's when I started writing on the blog.
You have adapted a blog entry for your piece in the show. Will you read it for us?
Sure. On the day Hudson was born, as soon as I saw her, I started tearing my hospital gown off. I'd read about the importance of early skin-to-skin contact for establishing breastfeeding, and I was desperate to get her on my chest, to hold her close so she could smell me and try nursing. On the day Hudson died, we spent every moment beside her, knowing that at around 8:30 that night, the doctors would do a final test for brain death, and that barring some miracle, she would be declared dead. The ICU staff had told us that we could hold her, even though she was hooked up to so many different tubes and machines. At the last minute, I decided to throw everyone but my husband and the nurses out of the room. I took off my shirt and my bra so I could hold her skin to skin. I thought to myself, wildly, that maybe, just like when she was born, the skin-to-skin contact would have a magical effect. I pictured her in my arms, against my chest, slowly regaining consciousness.
Mandy Hitchcock, reading from her entry in the program called Listen to Your Mother, which is on stage at the Keenan Auditorium in Raleigh tonight and Thursday night. What strikes me about this, it is certainly powerful, emotional. It is powerfully intimate, and it is something that when you share it, becomes something else entirely. You talked about the support network that you felt that needed to grow. I mean, it has that impact, both of those at once, very personal and intimate, and ultimately communal, and brings us all together.
It's true, and you know, I was thinking about this the other day about, you know, there are studies that show that parents who have endured stays in the ICU actually suffer from PTSD. So part of the process of telling this story over and over and over again is helping me therapeutically. But the bigger process and sort of what I was trying to do when I adapted this particular piece for the show is, in some ways, parts of this experience were universal. And what I have learned since Hudson died and since I have been putting these things out in the world is I have been stunned to get so much feedback about how sharing our story has helped other people. And that's incredibly meaningful for me because I say often that it's one of the only consolations I have after her death, because it helps me feel like her life continues to have an impact on the world, because her story can help people in a small way, whether it's another mother who's lost a child or someone whose friend has lost a child and they're not sure how to help them. Or even just mothers who are dealing with really frustrating situations and they sit and have an opportunity to sort of take a breath and think, but gosh, I'm really grateful to just be here in this moment with my child. And so all of those stories have just been incredibly meaningful to me. And I really appreciate the opportunity to sort of share that in a very communal and even universal way. So.
Was it difficult for you at first to put that story into words?
Orally. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, these ladies can attest that at our very first read through, I could almost barely get through my piece. You know, I had done it 10 times probably at home before I got ready for the audition. But at our first read through, I cried through most of it. And it's gotten better over time. We had our tech rehearsal last night, and it's very strange. One of our other co-producers, Marty Long, was talking about how people in the audience will react differently depending on where they are on that day or at that moment. And that's true for me. I broke up at a different point mm-hmm. in the piece last night than I had ever before. And I think it really just, it's interesting just to see how your emotions of the moment will mm-hmm. interact with your words, or someone else's words, as the case may be.
And the emotion in that room. But I think it's always a good thing to get a lot of people in a room together. And if many of them will cry at an authentic story together, there's probably no more therapeutic and no more human endeavor. So having a theatrical experience like this that reflects authentic experience is probably one of the most important things you can do. And I want to bring in yet another contributor. Joy Saliers is Executive Director of the North Carolina Folklife Institute and one of our contributors. Joy, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Your journey to motherhood was a little untraditional. tell us about it.
Well, you know, some people have that story about the stray animal that shows up on their doorstep and ends up on their couch. In our case, that happened to us with the boy who lived next door. So I say that I started motherhood with a teenager and then went back to infants afterward.
Tell us the story. Well, I guess we should probably have you read first,
sure.
And then you can fill us in.
Jack's dramatic arrival to live with us beat that of our first biological child by 10 months, and therefore he counts as my first son. Well, there we were, living in a tiny house on almost no money, me pregnant, and then with a new baby, taking care of a developmentally delayed teenager, getting him through high school and into the social service system, with no financial help and no support from his family. And was he grateful? Did he make it easy on us? Did he help out around the house? No. He was a typical teenager, argumentative, complaint-prone, and foot-dragging. My therapist explained to me that Jack was utterly egocentric and self-focused and was incapable of appreciating us. Maybe when he's 25, my therapist said, he'll call you up and tell you he's grateful for everything you did for him, but you can't count on it.
Tell us more about Jack.
Jack is great. He actually helped me pick my dress out for our performance.
Well, because the doctor's description really describes a male. So, but he's not just there is an actual clinical diagnosis, is there, or is there not for Jack?
I think it was really difficult for him because it's very hard to tell what kinds of difficulties and disabilities are congenital and what are connected to neglect. Mm. And unfortunately, in our system, we don't really count things that are caused by neglect. If there's not some kind of diagnosis that relates to you know, brain or something that happened from birth, you're kind of on your own. So it's always been extremely difficult for him to get any kind of of assistance. And in addition to that, his birth mother is fairly paranoid and worried about any intervention. So he didn't have any assistance at all until he was a teenager.
And he spent a lot of time at your doorstep because there wasn't much going on at home next door, right?
Right. His mother worked double shifts as a security guard, was very rarely home, and he was mostly on his own, living, you know, kind of in his own head a lot of the time. And he was, you know, it was interesting because he was in one way, very shy and skittish, almost you would think like someone on the autism spectrum. And then at the same time, you know, he just felt totally comfortable, like just pushing his way into our house and our lives and becoming part of our family.
So you spent a lot of time taking him in and making him part of the family. But then at one point, there was the question about whether how far you would go, right? I mean, he found himself utterly abandoned.
Yeah. He literally called us on the street. He had his mother moved to a different city and left him in Durham.
And how old was he?
It was his 17th birthday when he was officially kind of homeless. He had been staying on friends' couches and, you know, making do, wanting to stay in his high school. As you can imagine, change was difficult for him. So the idea of starting over someplace, he really wanted to try to finish school. So he was kind of trying to make that happen, and eventually, you know, it didn't work out.
Interestingly enough, you thought about foster care, but tell us about that exchange.
Well, we actually did talk to social services, and I think it may be different now, but at the time, their advice to us was to let us know that if we kind of reported him officially to social services and he was placed in foster care, then we would lose all kind of input or control, and he could be placed anywhere. And we thought that would be really devastating to him. We had hoped we could get trained as foster parents and, you know, kind of have an agreement that we could foster him. But since that didn't seem possible, we just took him in kind of off under the radar and off the record.
And how long ago was that?
Well, he's 25.
Have you heard from him?
Yeah, he stayed the night at my house on Sunday. He'll be there tonight in the performance in the audience. So
Kian, tell me how this has changed. You said this is the second production here in the Triangle. How did things change for you this second time around?
Well, this time we say that we don't so much put the show together as it curated. And so we take the stories and we're trying to find the best fit. And this year's stories run the gamut of a variety of experiences of motherhood. We've got women who were not themselves mothers who had to take care of their mothers. We have untraditional paths to motherhood through fostering and surrogacy. We also have health scares. So it's a much broader range of stories, and I think that anyone can find anything to relate to.
I take this as your Mother's Day gift to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank all of you for being on the program. Kian Hoag, Amanda Hitchcock, and Joy Saliers, you can listen to your mother. Listen to your mother. Well, you can listen to your mother anytime. Listen to your mother all the time. She's in your head. She's in my head. I mean, I have to make a phone call to listen to my mother, and yet I'm listening to her even now. Listen to Your Mother is a show that's on stage at Keenan Auditorium in Raleigh tonight and Thursday, May 8th. And you can find out more details and see photos of the mothers at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Coming up, some local movie stars at the Lemur Center in Durham. Stay tuned.